In a world where mainstream media presents itself as a marketplace of ideas, Noam Chomsky stands as one of the most penetrating critics of how power actually operates. Understanding Power isn't merely a book, it's an intellectual earthquake that has reshaped how millions view the relationship between governments, corporations, and citizens. Since its publication, this collection of Chomsky's teach-ins and discussions has become required reading in universities worldwide and counts influential figures from Bernie Sanders to Greta Thunberg among its admirers. What makes this work particularly remarkable is how it transforms complex power analyses into accessible, compelling narratives that resonate with readers regardless of their academic background. The media doesn't simply report news, it constructs reality through systematic filters that serve power. Chomsky's propaganda model explains how mainstream media functions not through crude censorship, but through sophisticated mechanisms that marginalize dissenting voices while creating an illusion of robust debate. Major media outlets are corporations selling specific audiences to advertisers, particularly privileged elite audiences from decision-making classes. This structure naturally produces content reflecting the perspectives of both media corporations and their advertisers, while systematically excluding voices that might challenge fundamental power structures. The model identifies five key filters through which news must pass: ownership structure, advertising dependence, reliance on government and corporate sources, organized flake against dissent, and anti-communism, now expanded to anti-terrorism. These filters operate simultaneously, creating a powerful system of indirect control. For instance, media outlets dependent on corporate advertising rarely produce content critical of consumer culture or corporate power. Similarly, journalists' heavy reliance on official sources means government perspectives dominate coverage of foreign policy and national security. When journalists internalize these constraints, explicit censorship becomes unnecessary. Reporters learn to anticipate what stories will be acceptable and how to frame issues within acceptable parameters. As Chomsky explains, the media presents debate only within a framework that serves dominant institutions, creating what I call brainwashing under freedom, where responsible critics help the system by keeping debate within acceptable limits. This self-censorship is far more effective than direct control. The model's predictions are strikingly confirmed through paired examples comparing coverage of similar atrocities. When Indonesia massacred East Timorese with American weapons, coverage virtually disappeared. Yet when comparable events occurred in Cambodia under Pol Pot, American media provided extensive coverage that emphasized communist brutality while minimizing U.S. responsibility. Similar patterns emerged in coverage of elections. Those in U.S.-allied states received minimal scrutiny of irregularities, while elections in adversary states faced intense criticism regardless of their actual conduct. This isn't conspiracy, but institutional logic. Media organizations actively welcome criticism from the right as accusations of being subversive allow them to portray themselves as courageously independent. However, they strongly resist criticism suggesting they function honestly but subordinated to power structures. The Washington Post's handling of the Pentagon Papers versus Watergate illustrates this dynamic. While celebrated for challenging Nixon, their Pentagon Papers coverage carefully avoided questioning the fundamental premises of American foreign policy. The system's effectiveness lies in its invisibility. Unlike Soviet censorship, Western media indoctrination operates through implicit assumptions that frame all legitimate discussion. This creates what Chomsky calls necessary illusions, beliefs that seem self-evident but actually serve power. The genius of this system is that most participants genuinely believe they're independent thinkers, making the propaganda far more effective than anything possible in authoritarian societies. Even the existence of alternative media and occasional critical coverage serves the system by fostering the impression of genuine debate while keeping fundamental power structures unchallenged. Military spending isn't primarily about defense, it's about maintaining a particular economic order. After World War II, American policymakers faced a dilemma. The wartime economy had finally ended the Great Depression through massive government spending, but continuing such intervention in peacetime risked democratizing economic power. The solution was military spending, which provided economic stimulus while keeping power concentrated in the hands of corporate and government elites. This approach became known as military Keynesianism, using defense spending rather than social programs to manage the economy. The word to talk was not subsidy. The word to talk was security, explained Air Force Secretary Stuart Symington in 1948. This framing allowed government to subsidize high-technology industries without public interference or debate. Unlike social spending that might encourage democratic participation and oversight, military spending gives corporate managers direct gifts with minimal accountability. The classified nature of defense work further insulated these arrangements from public scrutiny. The Pentagon system proved remarkably effective at developing technologies that later drove commercial industries. By 1958, the Defense Department funded approximately 85% of electronics R&D, with military purchases representing up to 100% of early computer output. Companies like IBM, General Electric, and Boeing received substantial Pentagon funding, with defense contracts cross-subsidizing civilian activities and helping establish market dominance. The semiconductor industry, crucial to modern computing, was created almost entirely through military procurement in its early years, with the government purchasing chips at heavily subsidized prices until costs decreased enough for commercial viability. Even the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars, functioned primarily as a massive technology development program, with 80% of its $26 billion budget flowing to private industry regardless of its defensive viability. Programs like DARPA channeled billions to university and corporate researchers, developing crucial technologies like high-speed networking, graphical user interfaces, and integrated circuits that later formed the foundation of the digital economy. The Internet itself emerged from ARPANET, a Pentagon-funded project to create resilient computer networks. This arrangement serves multiple purposes. It justifies imperial actions abroad through the constant threat of enemies, controls the domestic population through fear and security rhetoric, and most importantly, provides a politically acceptable mechanism for state intervention in the economy. The military system was consciously designed to funnel public resources to private industry while maintaining centralized control over technological development and economic planning. Any conversion to social spending would require completely restructuring society to undermine this centralized control, as military spending creates a perfect cover for corporate welfare without democratic oversight. The success of this system can be measured not just in technological innovation, but its longevity. It has survived multiple administrations of both parties, economic cycles, and the end of the Cold War. Modern examples include massive investments in artificial intelligence, autonomous systems, and cybersecurity, ensuring that cutting-edge technology development remains firmly under Pentagon control while being presented as crucial for national defense. Political language serves as a sophisticated tool for ideological control, shaping public perception and discourse in ways that benefit those in power. Terminology carries dual meanings, a dictionary definition, and an ideologically loaded one used for propaganda purposes. This linguistic manipulation operates through careful word choice, implied meanings, and selective application of terms to similar situations. Consider how terrorism only applies to enemies' actions, while identical behavior by allies is labeled counterterrorism or security operations. When Palestinian groups attack Israeli targets, it's invariably terrorism. But when Israeli forces conduct similar operations in Gaza, it becomes defensive measures or security operations. Similarly, defense justifies even aggressive military actions, as seen in the naming of the Department of Defense, formerly War Department, while special interests refers to ordinary citizens, labor unions, and environmental groups, but never corporations or business lobbies. The term peace process illustrates this manipulation perfectly. A computer search of 900 New York Times articles showed 100% usage supporting the definition, whatever the U.S. is doing, despite America blocking major peace initiatives in both Central America and the Middle East. During the 1980s Nicaragua conflict, U.S. rejection of peace proposals was never seen as opposing the peace process, while similar actions by other nations were condemned. Similarly, countries are labeled democracies only if run by U.S.-friendly elites, regardless of human rights abuses or electoral integrity. This selective application was evident in Cold War-era Latin America, where brutal military dictatorships were often described as emerging democracies. Perhaps most revealing is the term moderate, which simply means follows U.S. orders. This label has been applied to absolute monarchs like Morocco's King Hassan, Saudi Arabia's royal family, and even Indonesia's Suharto, who slaughtered 500,000 people in a U.S.-backed 1965 coup that American media celebrated as a gleam of light in Asia. Egypt's Hosni Mubarak was consistently labeled moderate, despite decades of authoritarian rule, while democratically elected leaders who opposed U.S. policies were branded radical or extremist. These linguistic distortions aren't accidental, but represent what George Orwell called defense of the indefensible. By controlling language, power structures control thought itself. Media outlets reinforce these linguistic patterns through repetition and consistent usage, creating what scholars call manufactured consent. As Chomsky explains, the smart way to keep people passive and obedient is to strictly limit the spectrum of acceptable opinion, but allow very lively debate within that spectrum. This creates an illusion of freedom while ensuring fundamental power arrangements remain unchallenged. The impact extends beyond media discourse into academic and policy discussions. Terms like free market, structural adjustment, and economic reform carry positive connotations while masking often harsh policies. This linguistic framework shapes not just how we discuss politics, but how we conceive of political possibilities themselves. The standard narrative of American foreign policy, defending freedom against totalitarianism, crumbles under historical examination. Declassified documents repeatedly reveal that America's primary concern isn't opposing left-wing governments, but preventing independence regardless of ideology. As the global hegemon, America ensures third world countries serve their assigned functions, providing markets, resources, and cheap labor for American business interests. This economic imperative has driven U.S. foreign policy far more than ideological concerns about democracy or communism. This pattern explains why the U.S. has routinely overthrown democratically elected governments while supporting brutal dictatorships. In 1953, the CIA orchestrated a coup against Iran's democratic government under Mohammad Mossadegh, not because it was communist, it wasn't, but because it sought to nationalize its oil resources from British Petroleum. The operation, known as Ajax, installed the Shah, whose 26-year dictatorship served Western oil interests while brutalizing his own people. Similarly, Guatemala's democratic government under Jacobo Arbenz was overthrown in 1954 for implementing mild land reforms that threatened United Fruit Company's interests. The company owned vast unused lands and wielded enormous influence over U.S. policy through connections with the Dulles brothers. The classic technique for such operations involves arming a country's military while making civilian governance impossible through economic warfare and propaganda campaigns. In Chile, the U.S. armed the military and created economic chaos through what Nixon called making the economy scream, until they overthrew democratically elected Salvador Allende in 1973. The subsequent Pinochet dictatorship implemented free market policies while torturing and killing thousands. As Henry Kissinger bluntly stated regarding Chile, "I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its own people." Even more revealing is Operation Mongoose, Kennedy's massive terrorist campaign against Cuba after the Bay of Pigs failure. This involved bombing civilian targets, contaminating sugar exports, sabotaging factories, and multiple assassination attempts against Castro with a $50 million annual budget and 2,500 personnel, what Chomsky calls the world's leading single international terrorist operation. The U.S. decided to overthrow Castro in March 1960 before any significant Soviet involvement, proving the issue wasn't Cold War politics but Cuban independence from American economic control. The areas most under U.S. control have often suffered the worst outcomes. Central America remains plagued by poverty and violence after decades of U.S.-backed dictatorships and counterinsurgency campaigns. In northeast Brazil, chronic malnutrition has created a population with 40% normal brain size, despite the region's rich agricultural potential. In contrast, countries that developed economically were those that either avoided colonization or successfully resisted Western economic models. Japan industrialized by protecting its economy through the Meiji period, and its former colonies like Taiwan and South Korea developed by following similar protectionist policies, precisely the approach the U.S. prevents Latin American countries from implementing through various forms of economic and military pressure. This pattern of enforced underdevelopment continues today through institutions like the IMF and World Bank, which impose free market policies that benefit Western corporations while limiting independent development. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict illustrates how power shapes both policy and perception. Despite mainstream portrayal as an intractable ethnic conflict, declassified documents reveal a consistent pattern of U.S. and Israeli rejection of diplomatic solutions. Since the 1970s, there has been international consensus supporting a two-state solution based on pre-1967 borders with security guarantees for all states in the region. The PLO accepted this framework in 1976, and Arab states, including Egypt, proposed peace initiatives along these lines. Yet the U.S. systematically blocked these diplomatic efforts while publicly claiming to support peace. Why? Because peace threatens America's strategic use of Israel. If Israel normalized relations and integrated into the region, its value to the United States is essentially over. America needs Israel, dependent and embattled, to serve as a reliable proxy in a region containing the greatest petroleum resources in the world. As declassified U.S. documents from 1958 reveal, America's strategic view of Arab nationalism was that it threatened control of oil resources, with Israel positioned as the only strong pro-West power to help combat radical Arab nationalism. The Camp David Accords, while portrayed as advancing peace, strategically isolated Egypt from the Arab coalition, freeing Israel to consolidate control over the West Bank and Gaza. As recognized by strategic analysts, removing Egypt from military conflict enabled Israel's 1982 Lebanon invasion and accelerated settlement expansion. The Oslo Agreement of 1993 represented the culmination of this strategy, creating territories with even less independence than South African Bantustans had under apartheid. Israeli commentators themselves described the arrangement as neo-colonialism. The agreement ensured any settlement would be based solely on UN Resolution 242, which doesn't address Palestinian rights, while Israel continued massive construction throughout the occupied territories. The strategy has been to have local authorities patrol these areas while Israel maintains control, like asking the New York police if they'd like to turn Harlem over to local authorities while keeping Wall Street and the Upper East Side. This approach represents what Chomsky calls an overwhelming victory for Israel, eliminating any possibility of Palestinian self-determination. The permanent war economy emerged as the solution to America's economic challenges after the Great Depression. Despite New Deal efforts, real GDP only regained its 1929 level by 1939, with unemployment averaging nearly 19% throughout the 1930s. What truly ended the Depression was World War II, when military spending jumped six-fold to 11% of GDP by 1941, and later reached 42% during 1943-44. Under this stimulus, real national product increased 65% from 1940-1944. Post-war economists warned that the economy had become dependent on government spending. Paul Samuelson wrote that, "We have reached present high levels of output and employment only by means of $100 billion of government expenditures." Industries like aircraft manufacturing became entirely dependent on government support, producing at just 3% of wartime capacity by 1948 and facing disaster without intervention. The Truman administration discovered in the Cold War a magic formula for economic management, using military spending as an automatic pump primer that could be adjusted as needed without fundamentally altering economic structures like welfare or public works spending would. Business publications openly acknowledge that rearmament has played a large part in economic stability. This system became entrenched through a carefully maintained pretense, avoiding any language that might suggest government subsidy of private industry. As Boeing's president William Allen insisted, profits should be calculated based on sales rather than investments to hide how dependent the aircraft industry was on public money. Industry leaders feared that if taxpayers realized how much they were funding these corporations, they might demand nationalization. As Air Force Secretary Symington candidly advised, the word to talk was not subsidy, the word to talk was security. By the 1980s, military manufacturing had become so deeply embedded that research showed half of all U.S. manufacturing plants were connected to defense production. The entire high technology sector, computers, electronics, aerospace, was developed primarily through Pentagon funding and continues to rely heavily on military contracts. This represents what economists call state capitalism rather than a free market, a system where government investment drives the economy while profits remain private. Democracy faces a fundamental challenge. As long as wealth remains privately concentrated, everyone must prioritize keeping the rich happy, or else face capital flight and economic collapse. This dynamic plays out repeatedly in countries that elect reform candidates. From Latin America to Southeast Asia, international investors immediately withdraw capital, causing currency crashes and market instability that force policy reversals regardless of democratic mandates. Greece's experience in 2015 provides a stark example, where voter rejection of austerity measures was effectively overruled by international financial pressure. The international financial system has been deliberately transformed to enhance this power. By the 1990s, over 95% of international capital was used for speculation rather than productive investment or trade. With $1 trillion moving daily in speculative markets, the international investing community holds virtual veto power over national governments. The Asian financial crisis of 1997-98 demonstrated how quickly speculative capital flows could devastate entire economies, regardless of their underlying economic fundamentals. This explains why the Clinton administration abandoned campaign promises for economic stimulus in 1993. As the Wall Street Journal explained, the massive U.S. debt created under Reagan/Bush prevented Clinton from pursuing social reform. With $150 billion in Treasury securities traded daily, investors could instantly raise interest rates by selling off bonds, adding billions to the deficit overnight, and effectively neutralizing any proposed social spending. The bond market's reaction to even modest reform proposals sent clear signals about acceptable policy boundaries. What's emerging is a new form of governance, a de facto world government designed to serve international corporate interests through structures like NAFTA, GATT, the IMF, World Bank, and G7. These institutions centralize power in a system deliberately remote from public understanding or influence. The World Bank calls this technocratic insulation, ensuring decisions are made by corporate-aligned technocrats beyond public reach. The WTO's dispute resolution system, for example, can effectively override national environmental and labor laws behind closed doors. This represents a profound crisis for democracy. As The Economist bluntly stated regarding Eastern European countries voting socialists back into power, policy is insulated from politics. The message is clear. You can vote for whoever you want, but economic policy will remain constrained within narrow neoliberal parameters. Argentina's experience in the early 2000s demonstrated how even severe economic crisis and popular uprising couldn't fundamentally alter these constraints. The consequences are devastating and measurable. Since the mid-1970s, economic growth has slowed dramatically, while virtually all created wealth has flowed to the top income brackets. The typical American family now works about 15 weeks more per year than 20 years ago, yet with stagnating or declining real incomes. Young workers have been hit hardest, with entry-level wages 20 to 30% lower than 20 years earlier. This trend has accelerated post-2008, with 95% of income gains during the recovery going to the top 1% of earners. Meanwhile, secure employment has given way to the gig economy, temporary contracts, and automated job displacement, creating profound economic insecurity for the majority. Despite these challenges, Chomsky remains cautiously optimistic about possibilities for change. He points to significant achievements of popular movements, from civil rights legislation to preventing direct military intervention in Central America during the 1980s. The decentralized nature of modern activism makes it harder to suppress, he notes, and concrete achievements like human rights legislation have saved lives and represent meaningful progress born from grassroots organizing. The key to effective resistance lies in building alternative institutions and connections between diverse movements. Chomsky emphasizes that we lack the structure of popular institutions within which to work. Not long ago, a group like this would have met in labor union headquarters, not in places like churches or campuses. Rebuilding these structures requires integrating environmental, labor, racial justice, and anti-war movements into interconnected networks with shared resources and media. International solidarity has become essential as corporations globalize production to undermine labor standards. When Daimler-Benz threatened German work standards by moving to non-unionized Alabama, or when Caterpillar used Brazilian plants to break strikes in Illinois, they demonstrated how capital mobility requires worker solidarity across borders. Some promising developments have emerged. After NAFTA passed, when General Electric fired Mexican workers attempting to unionize, American unions intervened to defend them in the first such cross-border solidarity action. Alternative media plays a crucial role in this process. Chomsky notes that communities with listener-supported radio have a different feel, providing places where people can connect and develop alternative conceptions of reality. Building serious alternative media at scale can consistently present a different picture of the world than the one provided by corporate-controlled indoctrination systems. The environmental crisis adds urgency to this organizing. Chomsky warns that within a couple hundred years, rising water levels could destroy most human life if we don't act now. Addressing this requires unprecedented social planning and psychological shifts away from greed-driven economics before we make the planet uninhabitable. Ultimately, Chomsky argues that change comes from many unknown people working at the grassroots level, not from famous leaders. The real agents of change in history are usually forgotten, he explains. Martin Luther King could give speeches because SNCC workers and freedom riders had prepared the ground by taking brutal beatings. This erasure of real changemakers is deliberate. Part of disempowering people is making them think only great men create change, when in reality, it's always organized communities working together.